You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, August 16th, 2016.
We recognize that this is a high expense, but we think that there's a legitimate reason for doing it. I don't think anybody went in with this with the intent of hoping to discourage people from requesting this type of record.
Public access to police body camera footage doesn't come cheap in Bloomington. News director Joe Crawford speaks with a city attorney later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the ins and outs of money, our weekly segment providing economic education and community resources that keep your budget balanced and your finances flourishing. But first, these local headlines.
A group of white nationalists, anti-Muslim activists, and self-described patriots have hit a roadblock in their plans to hold a get-together in central Indiana. The Traditionalist Workers' Party and the Sons and Daughters of Liberty Project had planned to hold a dinner this Saturday at the Charlottesville Lions Club, about 40 minutes east of Indianapolis. But this afternoon, a spokesman for the Lions Club International said those plans are now off. Dane LaJoy told WFHB that he received calls from members of the public concerned about the club hosting an event for white nationalists. LaJoy says he then spoke with a member of the Charlottesville Club who explained the situation.
They do rent their little clubhouse to other groups, so local civic groups, probably birthday parties, etc. Earns extra money for their club. He had gotten a call about a month ago from an individual who was interested in renting it on Saturday, August 20th, and the Lion rep from the club, you know, looked at the calendar and he said, "Well, we don't have anything scheduled at the clubhouse at this time." He didn't ask, nor did the person provide information with regard to who he represented. As it turned out, there was no contract. There was no deposit that was paid. The club has, as of yesterday, contacted the organization that had called to reserve the rental of the clubhouse and said it's not available.
The event had been scheduled to play host to several controversial organizations, including the Indiana chapter of the Soldiers of Odin. That group was founded last year in Finland as an anti-Muslim street patrol with the stated aim of protecting citizens from criminal immigrants. One of the organizers of the event, the Traditionalist Workers' Party, is described as a white nationalist group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. In June, the Traditionalist Workers' Party organized a rally in Sacramento that turned violent after they were confronted by about 400 counter-protesters. LaJoy says the International Lions Club told the Charlottesville chapter that hosting the event would not represent the organization's ethics and values. He says the Lions Club typically stays out of politics altogether.
If a club has someone in to speak at their club meeting, like a politician running for office, and let's say they invite a Republican, they're free to do that, but then they also have to make time available to any opposing candidate that would come in and want to speak to the club. They can't just say, well, we're only going to invite Republicans, or we're only going to invite Democrats, or Libertarians, or whatever the case, independent candidate. But we are non-political, non-sectarian.
So far, the organizers of the event have not announced whether they will relocate.
Mayor Hamilton's office has released the findings of the Innovation Task Force, a six-month project by a group of city, community, and university leaders to improve the efficiency of local government. The task force's final report contains a list of 11 priorities, ranging from creating new government positions to volunteer-based efforts to control invasive species. The top recommendation was the creation of a Department of Innovation, which would study efficiency programs in other cities. City spokesperson Mary Catherine Carmichael says adopting that recommendation is likely to be a priority for Mayor Hamilton.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting idea, one that many, many communities have already adopted. I think that we're all aware of the fast pace of change and new ways of doing things, and I think that that director would be looking for best practices, whether that be processes or technology that they could bring to the city of Bloomington to help us be better stewards of taxpayers' money and just provide city services at the absolute best level we can. That's something that I've been with Mayor Hamilton through his campaign, so this is something I know he's thought about, again, based on best practices of other really effective cities. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see him embrace that recommendation wholeheartedly.
Other recommendations from the Innovation Task Force include collecting more efficiency data, creating a public engagement office, and restoring the city's ombudsman position, which was previously eliminated by budget cuts. The task force also suggested exploring participatory budgeting, a process by which the public can generate proposals for budget money and then directly vote on them. The task force also suggested the city choose one or two neighborhoods and run a pilot program where residents can vote on how a small amount of money is spent. Participation in the task force was entirely voluntary and did not require any expenditures from the city. Participants included staff from the Kelly School of Business and the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, several city employees, local consultants, and members of two nonprofits.
The Monroe County Metropolitan Planning Organization Committee met with the Indiana Department of Transportation on Friday to discuss the slowdown in construction on Section 5 of I-69. Section 5 is the portion that connects Martinsville and Bloomington. The committee's concern is that the project will not be finished by the completion date of June 28, 2017. Another concern is that the construction will cause major delays for people traveling to IU for sporting events and other activities. Gary Vandegrift from I-69 Development Partners says that although they would like to open up the roads to make IU travel easier, they cannot due to safety reasons.
What I will tell you, since December of 2014, when we took over operation of the road, we have been in weekly, if not more often, contact with the IU Athletic Department in regards to visitors coming to the game. We have been in seasonal contact, if you will, with the IU student folks in regards to move out and move in. And we are keenly aware of the traffic issues that that creates. Does that mean we can open up everything? No, it doesn't, because there are safety issues that we have to protect with lane closures. But what we can do is be keenly aware of the activities that are going on, follow our technical provisions, and stay in communication in both social media, on the phone, and in person with folks at IU and others as needed for that traffic issue.
Vandegrift also said that the contractor will be able to finish the project by the projected finish date.
The subcontractors that our design build contractor have brought on board that are actually doing the work here are three of what I would consider the top contractors in their area of work in the state of Indiana. The excavating contractor, the structures or bridge building contractor, and the paving contractor are at the top of the list when it comes to people who are in that business. So as a developer, we believe that the design builder, in working with their subs, has the capability of delivering the project.
Mayor John Hamilton said that moving forward, he wishes for more transparency from the project.
I think transparency in where we are is essential. I talk about that a lot. Transparency is not always fun or comfortable, but we have thousands of people going back and forth, and obviously with a date that's moved once, there's concern about the date and trying to understand where we are. In addition, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of workers who are active or potentially active on the site.
The committee asked the Indiana Department of Transportation and the I-69 Development Partners for an update in 60 days. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. The city of Bloomington has officially adopted new rules that dramatically increase the cost of accessing footage from police body cameras and dash cams. The standard fee for accessing a single video is now $150, the maximum allowed by state law. Until this summer, the fee was $20. The increase comes amid rising tensions around the country between police departments and the public, with instances of documented police violence regularly setting off major protests. Bloomington City Attorney Patty Mulville Hill worked with city officials to propose the increase. She spoke with WFHB News Director Joe Crawford about the new fee, and we bring you their conversation now for today's WFHB Community Report.
Can you talk about what the decision-making process was like to first propose the $150 fee?
So what happened is the General Assembly enacted House Enrolled Act 1019 during their last session. And what they did a couple things. And what got all the press was that police agencies that use body cameras were going to have to keep those footage for 190 days. What kind of got missed in the whole thing is when the actual House Enrolled Act was passed, they put in a bunch of other requirements about how we keep not just body camera footage, but how we keep dash cam footage, how we keep surveillance footage, and what we do with radio traffic. So what happens is, let's take, for example, a typical domestic violence call. So let's say I send two officers en route because we have a complaint of a domestic violence incident. Both officers are going to have their dash cams going. They're both going to have their body camera footage going, and they're also going to be communicating with each other, other officers, their commanders, and central dispatch on their radio. What the new law says is that we are required to redact certain portions of those videos so that the average public can't see them. Examples would include victims of sexual assault, minors. So if we go to domestic violence and there's any evidence of sexual assault, we would have to redact that victim's face. If there's minors in the home, we then have to redact them as well. To make things even more complicated, the state police agency that oversees what I'm going to call, like, where we get our criminal history information from, it's called IDACS. Under the rules for the state police, we have to keep information we get from IDACS completely confidential. We're not allowed to release it. If you release it, you run the risk of having the IDACS coordinator revoke your ability to use it, which is problematic for investigating crimes. Our officers on their radios are going to be getting confidential IDACS information on most of their runs because they're running plates, they're getting background information on alleged suspects. So what happens is we've got all of this footage that we now have to take. So if you take that domestic violence call, and let's say it even takes just takes an hour to resolve, I have 1 hour dash cam videos I've got to go through, 2 1-hour body cam footage that I got to go through, and 2 sets of radio traffic. And then I have to redact all of that information that I'm not allowed to show anymore. And then I got to double check to make sure I redacted it properly. So $150 is the maximum we can charge, but it's not going to cover the cost of one city employee spending all day going through 6 hours of video and radio traffic and then redacting the same.
Well, let me make sure, though, I understand that, because I thought it was $150 per camera per incident.
Yeah, so it'll be $150 per camera for that. But even just doing one camera can take long.
But in the instance that you described, if you had 6 different cameras,
yeah,
that would be $900.
I can't do math in my head. If you tell me 125 times that, that's correct.
It'd be 150 times 6, right? So that'd be $900.
Yeah.
So the justification is that because you have an employee who is making some amount of money and they're sitting in front of a computer editing this for a certain amount of time, it was come up with $150 would be an appropriate amount.
Correct. And then also the added expense that we have to do in buying all of the new software and server packages.
Well, how was the decision actually made? Was it the police department who suggested this amount?
No, I mean, we sat down and talked internally in the administration about what we could maximize charge for, looked at what we thought would reasonably take us to recoup the expense of all of the new equipment we would have to buy, and then how much it would cost us in terms of personnel time to actually comply with these costs, and determined that $150 would probably not even cover our costs.
I just wonder about philosophy behind that discussion or the thinking behind it, because I realize that a lot of what city government does, it's not really possible to recoup the money for. You know, if you just call the police, you don't get charged a fee for the police to come to your house and investigate. And I assume that somewhere it's understood that that's the function of the police department, so they should do that without charging a fee for that service. So how is it decided that providing this body camera footage was not somehow important enough to the mission of the police department to warrant providing for free?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that specific question. I mean, I don't even know that that's necessarily the level we went into so much as, and I would say that I don't know that, I mean, the mission of the police department is to prevent crime, and it's not as if we're, I mean, people who request these videos aren't always, it's not always, I mean, it's sometimes it's just random members of the press. Sometimes it's also people who are just, quite frankly, two neighbors fighting with each other over something, and police officers got called, and now there's a civil claim that they're involved in that we're not party to. I don't know that we got into that level of discussion. It was really an amount of, this is going to be an expense that we were not planning on spending. It's going to create time for personnel that we did not budget for. And it was, we didn't want to be one of the agencies that said, we can't afford this, we're going to have to let them go.
Is there any provision that would make it possible to get a waiver if it was, if the person requesting the footage was, let's say, low income or had some justification for not being able to pay the fee?
No, there's no provision for any of the waivers in that section of the code.
Was there any discussion about just recent events across the country and the sensitivity, basically the importance of police body camera footage in trying to understand some of these incidents, especially involving men who have been black and frankly who've also been low income? Was there any discussion about how that would be perceived in the community?
Not with me directly, no. It could have happened at a different level, but not that I was engaged in.
And how many requests does the city get for this kind of footage? How many have they received since the new law was put in place?
I can't answer that. You'd have to ask the police department that question.
Was there was no discussion about how often this kind of thing happens?
We discussed about how many we had gotten to date, and it was a couple of months, if I remember correctly. Again, the police department's going to have the records on those. But what I do know is that we were starting to see an uptake in the number of requests we were getting, because remember, body cameras are relatively new, particularly for our department. We did have one particular law firm that had started requesting them in every traffic accident, personal injury case they were representing somebody in.
Lastly, and I think this is the way that it might look to some folks, but you know, do you think that this increase was supported at all in an attempt to limit the number of requests for police body camera footage or discourage people, especially people without much money, from, you know, trying to see the footage of arrests?
No. I at no point in any of the conversations that I had with any member of the police department, the legal department, the administration, or all nine members of the city council and their staff was that ever even raised.
So there wasn't even a conversation about, boy, this might sort of look like that's what is happening?
I mean, I think at the city council meeting, there was people who were saying this is really, we recognize that this is a high expense, but we think that there's a legitimate reason for doing it. I don't think anybody went in with this with the intent of hoping to discourage people from requesting this type of record. That was never an intent that was expressed to me personally, that they were trying to dissuade people from getting these records.
All right, Patty, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Ain't no problem.
That was Bloomington City Attorney Patty Mulvihill speaking with WFHB News Director Joe Crawford. Mulvihill officially left her job at the city last week to take a job representing cities and towns in Oregon. WFHB has submitted a public records request seeking information about how frequently citizens request to see police camera footage. That request is pending.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly financial segment, The Ins and Outs of Money.
It's The Ins and Outs of Money, presented by the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Quick tips for getting control of your money, no matter how big or small your income or family is.
Hi, and welcome again to the Ins and Outs of Money. I'm Ryan Stacey with the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. And today we're going to talk about something that you might be very familiar with, or you might be only vaguely familiar with. I'm talking about investing. Isn't investing inherently risky? I'm talking with Richard Shockley today. And Richard, you're professor of finance at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business, correct?
That's correct, Ryan. It's great to be with you.
So let me ask you, why would investing be a prudent way to spend your money?
Ryan, let's start out by separating investing from speculating or from gambling. When we think about, say, going to a casino, you might go and sit down and play a card game, and it's sort of a zero-sum game.
One person wins, everybody else loses.
That's right. Investing does more than speculating. Investing actually ultimately is what drives the economy to grow and helps us all be ultimately better off. You remember the gold rush back in the early 1800s. There are some businesses around today that actually originally made their money during the gold rush. They were not out trying to strike gold. Rather, they were providing products to sell to all of the gold miners. It didn't really matter to them who struck gold. They knew that if they could sell shovels, if they could sell jeans, if they could sell food, etc., they could make money because the economy was growing. They were investing a little bit in every miner, in essence. And so this is the notion of diversification.
So you mean maybe investing in several different companies or several different...
Even more broadly than that.
Okay.
You basically do it through mutual funds.
Mutual funds, okay.
Right. You let somebody do the diversification for you.
You've got to be talking about smaller returns, though, since it's maybe a little bit less risky.
This is the one place in the world where you get something for nothing. Diversification turns out to lower risk without sacrificing return. And once we start diversifying, we do give up the possibilities of having an explosively large return that one firm or one industry might have. Mm-hmm. But the upside of that is we protect ourselves against having these big downside return. All firms don't have good outcomes at the same time, and all firms don't have the really bad outcomes at the same mm-hmm. time. And the zigs kind of counteract the zags in any given time period. The long-run record for returns overall on average in the United States is really quite good. I am very, very happy as an investor to take the long run average return.
And that was going to be my next question. It sounds like you kind of have to be in it for the long game. It's not this, we're talking about a lifetime of investing.
Yes, absolutely. It's human nature to get really excited when good things are happening, but you have to stick with the plan.
What kind of financial shape do you need to make sure you are in before you take the step into investing? Is it for everybody?
Once you have money to invest, yes, it is for everyone. Now, if you are someone who is carrying a credit card balance, your best investment is in paying off that credit card balance.
Okay, but you're also not saying you don't have to be a millionaire to be able to invest a little bit of money.
No, not at all.
So it is worth it even with modest amounts of money.
Oh, it's absolutely worth it. In fact, the earlier you can start, the longer your horizon can be, the better off you are because your money works for you.
So Richard, we hear from a lot of people yelling at us on TV or telling us that this is the way to go with stocks. We don't hear so much about index funds. They're maybe not as sexy to talk about as the latest find. How do we know who to listen to about stocks and those media figures?
I don't watch those shows. I spend very little time every year thinking about my investment portfolio. I have a strategy of investing in broad-based index funds. A lot of people suffer from an inertia problem because they think it's just so complicated and that they're going to have to do so much research. And Ryan, I'll tell you, there are a lot of people in the world who want you to believe that mm-hmm. because they want you to pay them to do it for you. But I want to tell you, you can do it yourself. It doesn't require a lot of sophistication. It doesn't require a lot of research and study. What it requires is a little bit of discipline, that you stick with your plan for the long run.
Well, I'm glad you were able to come by today, Richard, to talk about how simple it can be for people to invest. Thank you very much. And I hope that you listening are thinking about investing the right way, the safe way. And good luck.
Good luck.
The Ins and Outs of Money is part of the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. It's produced by Ryan Stacey at Level Up, the Digital Creativity Center at the library. Executive producers Joe Crawford and Dan Witherid is our sound editor. Music courtesy of Flannel Graph Records. Tools for taking control of your money can be found at money.mcpl.info. That's money.mcpl, as in Monroe County Public Library, .info.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, Casey Ross, and Jared Hill. Our feature was produced by Joe Crawford.
The Ins and Outs of Money is produced by Ryan Stacey and associate producer Christina Wiltsey. It's part of the It's Your Money project at Monroe County Public Library. Our engineer is Jennifer Brooks. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
And you can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington's community radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.